Good morning. Welcome to the February edition of Black Book Talk. I'm Emma Jackson Ford, and I'm here with
Obi Hill, community historian.
Tricia Welch, librarian emeritus.
And we have a wonderful guest for you today.
We are each other's harvest, celebrating African American farmers, land, and legacy by Natalie Brissett. I tell you, I read a lot of books. I have read a lot of books, starting with Fun with Dick and Jane. But this book really brings a lot of fruit in the harvest. Could you explain to me and to the rest of us exactly how you came about writing this particular book?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, first I want to say thank you to you three for reaching out and getting in touch. I had no idea that you were the oldest, you know, book club out there and Black Book Club, and so this means a lot. So I started thinking about this book after I finished Queen Sugar. And because what I noticed during all the years that it took me to research Queen Sugar and write that novel, I noticed that there were increasingly fewer and fewer and fewer farmers who I was seeing in South Louisiana. And I knew that as popular as that show had been, as popular as Queen Sugar was as a show, and people would come to me all the time and say, maybe not exactly my family story, but I have land in my family, and, you know, we've had all of these conversations about land ownership and what that means, and I have farmers in my family, or my ancestors were farmers. And some people would come to me and say, you know, I used to have land in my families, but we lost it. And as I started to think about that, and I started to think about the farmers who I met when I was working on Queen Sugar and just how much I appreciated their story, and I started to think about what most people thought of when they thought of American farmers, they didn't think about Black people, right? They didn't think about, there was this whole part of our history that I felt had been lost or unexamined. And I really wanted to use this book as a way to say to readers, hold up now, this is not just fiction, you know? There are real people out there who have been doing this work for generations. There are young people who are coming back to farming. And I wanted to give them a platform to speak for themselves and tell their own stories in first-person narratives so that people would really have a more nuanced and fuller appreciation for this part of African American history. And that's really what kind of led me down the rabbit hole to start this book.
You talk about food justice and food sovereignty, food apartheid. You came across these ideas down in California because your parents, grandfather, what have you, had moved up to the Pacific Northwest and to California during the war years, during the Great Migration, during the war time. Could you explain how you came about this concept?
Sure. So when I was in college, I went to college in Berkeley, California, and my Uncle Lewis, my great uncle, lived across the bay in San Francisco. And this was a man who, you know, my father had known as a kid, and And when I would go to visit him, he lived in a part of the city. It was a historically Black neighborhood called the Fillmore. And typically when I would go over to visit him, I would take him some, like a bag of groceries. But one day I was running late. And so I had to go to this market in Oakland rather than the market in Berkeley. And I was horrified at the difference in the quality of the produce. It was appalling. You know, the greens were wilted, all the vegetables were wilted. It was insulting, frankly, to look at the way this grocery store in a Black neighborhood had been really ignored. And I started to think about that. And, you know, I was thinking about the market where I would usually go to buy groceries, which was close to campus. And that market had everything in it. And it really made me so angry. And it was really the first time I recognized that there was a big difference in the food that was available, even in grocery stores, to communities of color versus the food that was available to white communities. And I was infuriated by that fact. And that always kind of stuck with me, you know? And then when I started working on this book, I had the good fortune to meet Naima and Leah Pennyman of Soulfire Farm. And they're the two young women who are on the cover of the book. And they were the people who I first heard coin this term food apartheid. I'd heard of the word food desert, right? Which is the term that a lot of people use to describe, you know, a lot of communities of color that are underserved, where there's a liquor store, there's a, you know, a gas station, there's not real quality produce. And I heard that term food desert, but when I met the Pennymans, they used the word food apartheid. And I like that term more because that points to the idea that this food injustice that we see in our communities, this is intentional, right? This isn't accidental. This is deliberate. It is pervasive, just like apartheid was deliberate, right? And so that's why I really appreciate that term. And it feeds into that whole big question about, you know, if we can grow our own food, if we know how to grow our own food, as Black people have done forever, then we can have more of a say in our futures and in the way we live. We can be sovereign, we can be independent, right? We don't have to necessarily depend on these poor quality foods that we get at the store. And so it just celebrates that kind of lack of dependence.
The whole idea, these terms like food apartheid, this is all new to me. Mm-hmm. This is a part of my journey of life that I had never heard about or ever even thought about. So finding the book and I've been hearing this term lately for a while, but finding this book and starting to read it, I thought, this is a world I've never even thought about. Growing up in South Arkansas, about 15 minutes out of Louisiana, my grandparents had a huge garden. I mean, it looked like a commercial garden. My grandfather, all the grandkids in the summer worked in the garden, and I never thought about anybody. I don't think I ever thought about hungry, except for that feeling you feel when you're ready to eat, because they grew everything, watermelons, cantaloupe, corn, potatoes, peanuts, yams, just everything. And then I think I've lived in an apartment as a young married a couple of times, but there was always a place to grow a little something. And for years and years, I've grown tomatoes and peppers and whatever I want to grow here at my house. So I never thought about people not being able to grow their own food. And the stores seem to have really good vegetables and fruit here. So I never give it a thought. But this is a whole new thing to think about, because I've never really thought about food as something that was a scarcity.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and I think that you're fortunate that you have, had access to fresh fruits and vegetables, and, you come from that tradition. But I think if you look around at a lot of Black and brown people who live in cities, right, where they have the corner store, they have the corner bodega, they don't have, they live in a high-rise building where they might not have, place to grow a little something. And that is part of what I was thinking about with this book, because, I have some friends, I have a very good friend who has an organization in Harlem who works with young kids. And it's called Harlem Grown. And he helps these young kids to really, they take over plots of city land, empty vacant lots, and then they transform them into gardens. And they invite the neighborhood kids and the kids in the local school to come in and really learn how to grow seeds and grow food. And the story he tells is that so many of these little kids, they think vegetables come out of a can, or they think vegetables come out of a frozen packet, and they have not made that connection back to the land and back to the earth. And so I think that if you're fortunate to have access to a place where you can grow your own food, or you come from people who know how to grow their own food, or you have memories of growing up with a grandmother or grandfather, then you're very lucky. But there are lots and lots and lots of people who they don't have that experience, right? And so they don't even think of themselves as having that kind of ability to control the food that they put in their mouths. And that's part of what I was trying to talk about.
I want to hear more about the book itself, because it's a collection of essays and interviews. And I think it's educational, it's informative, it's enlightening. But I want to know how you made the decisions in terms, well, first tell our audience about the book, and then how you made the decision in terms of what you were going to put into this wonderful, wonderful mixture of voices in this book.
Thank you. Well, I'll start with the title. So the title, We Are Each Other's Harvest, comes from a Gwendolyn Brooks poem. And if you know your history of Black poets, Gwendolyn Brooks is one of the, great American Black poets. And she has this poem called Paul Robeson. And the last stanza of the poem says, "We are each other's harvest."
You want me to read it?
Yes.
It's right in front of me.
Okay.
And I love it. "We are each other's harvest. We are each other's business. We are each other's magnitude and bond." Because I just think that was just beautiful.
Yes. Yes. And so, when I came across that poem and I was looking for a title for the book, and I was trying to think about a title that really captured this idea of all of these people coming together, Black and brown people coming together and taking care of each other and really looking out for each other and what could come from that. When I saw that, I thought, oh, that's the title. That's the title. It just said everything I wanted to say. When I started thinking about this book and I started thinking about what I wanted to include, back then, the idea of, I knew that it had to have the history, of course, but I'm a novelist. I'm not a traditional historian. And the idea of spending 5 years in the archives trying to tell this story with a big history book just seemed like I just didn't feel like it's what I wanted to do. And I think I'm influenced by a lot of different things. I love photography. I love poetry. I love music. I love all of these different, I love history. And I thought to myself, I want this book to be a dynamic, engaging experience for the reader. I want this to be kind of a kaleidoscope of voices and first-person narratives and stories and poems.
Beautiful photographs.
And beautiful photographs. I wanted all of that to be in the book because I felt like, A, it would be more interesting for the reader, but B, it was the only way I could think about to express my love of this story, of this topic, and kind of wrap my arms around this enormous idea. So that's kind of how it came to be.
The combination of the photographs, the poetry, the essays, the diversity of ideas. You know, before you leave, we got to say a little bit more about Please Sugar. But okay. There's just so much more. So, I mean, I just thank you for that. I mean, whatever your interest, whatever genre appeals to you, there is something in this book. Would you read a little bit of the book, read up the little passage for us?
Sure.
Because we've talked about it so much, our listeners need to hear some of it.
So I will read just maybe the first page of the foreword to the book. And this really is kind of the first thing that you capture the first thing that you experience when you kind of crack back the cover. And it says this: drive east along Interstate 80 from San Francisco towards Sacramento, past vast acres of alfalfa, watermelon, and rice, and you'll eventually come upon a two-story mule of a solitary figure squinting across the land. Dressed in a plaid shirt, jeans, and work boots, a tuft of gray hair peeking out beneath a baseball cap, the figure kneels in a patch of sunflowers. With one hand, the figure cradles a husky yellow Labrador. The other hand points out to the horizon. The figure is a farmer. He's a middle-aged man, and he's white. The artist who painted the 20-by-20-foot mural titled Stewards of the Soil says that she meant to pay tribute to the farmers in her community. I don't fault her for wanting to honor them. Farming is difficult work. And I acknowledge that her mural reflects the picture most people have in mind when they envision the American farmer. And yet, every time I drive past it, I can't help but think it tells only part of the story. Surely somewhere across the thousands of acres, there must be a handful of black and brown farmers. Who are they? What stories might they tell if given the chance? And I'll stop there.
And thank you for giving them this chance to go right here.
You're welcome. And, you know, that's a true story. You know, I live in the Bay Area, and every time I would drive on that highway 80, leaving San Francisco, driving to Sacramento, I would pass that mural. And every time I would think to myself, doggone it, that is not the whole story of American farmers. There are black and brown people who have been doing this work for generations, and we're not hearing their voices. And so I wanted to kind of launch you into the book in a very personal way, where you got to think about these things the way I think about them and feel maybe some of the frustration and impatience at knowing that the story's not complete until we hear from these other people.
In the last few years, my mother has been ill, and so I go to Arkansas and stay sometimes 2 months, sometimes a few weeks. And I have noticed that farming has changed in our area. It used to be that in the fall, or even all summer, there were black farmers who would come in with trucks. They would have all kinds of produce to sell. They'd have purple hull peas, one of my favorites, and okra. And there's just not a lot of that going on anymore. I'm noticing fewer trucks and water. There used to be so many black watermelon men around. But this last year, I only saw one truck that had a black man on it selling watermelons.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what's going on, why the land is not being, maybe it's being farmed and they're selling to grocery stores or something and not so much to the people. But I did notice that there's a difference in just the way it was being sold to just regular people and how they would come down your road and holler out and set their truck up. They're not doing that anymore.
Yeah. I think that's true. You know, and it's sad because that's such a rich part of our history. And I think that there are a few reasons for that. I think that there's a generation of people who did that, and those folks are maybe passing on, or, you know, they're not passing down that tradition to the next generation. I think land is hard to get and it's expensive. And so young people who might want to farm have trouble getting the money together and the capital together that is required to have farmland. And it's a shame because having that direct contact between the growers and the people who buy your food, I think that's a very special thing. And, you know, the only way that I see that now, and it's not, I see that in the farmers markets, right? But even that is not the same. It's not the same, you know, because you've got to know where the farmers market is. You've got to, you know, it's not necessarily a farmer coming down your road, like you said, you know, or out there on the corner. It's not the same. And I would hate to think that it's a tradition that we're losing, but I fear that it is.
It's a painful tradition that we're losing, not to mention their prices are so high now, yeah. As opposed to, I remember when the watermelon man used to come, my mother would buy, like if it was the end of his day, she would say, just give me the rest of what you have and give me a price. Mm-hmm. And she would take all the watermelons and we'd throw them into the house. That's not happening anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. It makes me sad.
Well, the main thing that I see here is a vivid picture, not imagination, but of reality from all the way from Reconstruction to the present day. Is there any way to explain making some fundamental changes? In the book, you mentioned that the federal government was buying or taking, moving black farmers off of property. What can we do collectively to begin the process of changing and going back to a system where we can operate farms again as independent and cooperative?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there, and part of what I wanted to share in the book, you know, this question of land loss is a big one for Black people. And one of the statistics that I cite in the book is the fact that in 1920, there were almost 1 million Black farmers, 1 million. And that by 2017, there were less than 45,000. In 1920, Black people had access to, were stewards of almost 14 million acres of farmland in this country. And by 2017, that number had dropped down to just, I think, like 1 million acres. And that's alarming when you think about the loss of wealth in the Black community. You think of how you have this asset that our ancestors, our grandmothers, great-grandmothers, great-great-grandmothers understood the importance of land, but that land has been lost over the generations. And I wanted to try to explain how that happened and why that happened. And there are two big reasons. The first reason is an issue called heirs' property, where, let's say, your grandmother owned land after the Civil War, or, you know, during emancipation, or I mean, during the Reconstruction or in the early 1900s. And when she died, that land was divided between her children. And then the next generation comes along and the land is redivided between the children, right? And it's divided and divided and divided and divided over the generations. But the problem is nobody ever put that land in a trust. And often there was not even a will that initial descent ancestor created. And so what has happened over the generations is that land is kind of loosely held by the family members, but because there is no official entity to protect it, all it requires is for one outsider to come in and buy a portion of that land, and they can force the sale of all the other members. And that has led to this tremendous land loss. The second reason people have lost land is because of the USDA and their racist lending practices, where they have lent money to Black farmers, forced them to be over-collateralized, and then when they can't pay the loans back, the government goes in and seizes that land. So you have those two forces that have really contributed to this tremendous land loss.
Unbelievable as it is, I think we have about a minute left. So obviously you need to come back. But I'm sorry, I can't let you go without saying, for the millions of people who I know agree with me, thank you so much for Queen Sugar. And you can just give me a quick yes or no. Do you feel that the TV show that we all saw and loved was faithful to the book that you wrote?
I think in the heart and the spirit of the TV show was the heart and the spirit of the book. You know, I know that they had to change some things from the book. They had to change characters and all that. And that's okay. That's okay. But what I love is that they were very thoughtful about the changes that they made. And they were trying to continue the conversation I started in the book. And that was fine with me. That was fine.
Thank you so much for writing the book, Queen Sugar, that inspired all this. And those of you who are interested, there are sections about Queen Sugar in this book. But also, thank you so much for joining us today on Black Book Talk. And again, folks, the book is called We Are Each Other's Harvest. And we've been talking to Natalie Bazile. Thank you so much for joining us.
Very welcome. You're welcome. Thank you again.
Thank you for writing both books, and thank you for being our guest.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate the invitation.
All right. We'll see you next month for the March edition of Black Book Talk. Until then, keep reading.